Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we chat with Alan Eccles from Gimlet at Cavendish House about the experience of helping conceptualise and open the restaurant and about his journey as head chef across some of Melbourne's top venues. Okay, let's get started. Welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. My name is Steph Posthuma. Thank you so much for joining us. Alongside me, as always, chef, sommelier, and all-around good bloke, Simon Evans.
Bloody good bloke. Hello.
And we find ourselves here in Melbourne, really, really lucky to be here. And to begin our podcast, we'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and speak today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, let's start and introduce our fantastic guest. You guys might not recognise this bloke, but this is Alan Eccles, who's the head chef at Gimlet at Cavendish House here in Melbourne. Mate, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Long-time listener, first-time guest. For those who don't know, Alan is a mate of mine from Canberra, from the days back in Canberra.
Back in the day.
Alan used to go to Tilopia Park High. And Narrabunda College,
yeah,
which is just down the road from where I grew up in Canberra.
Quite a few hospitality people came out of that school, it seems.
Yeah.
That little region.
Bunda.
I know a couple.
Yeah, I know. There's a good little community that's come out of Canberra. Yeah. Some have stayed, some have left. But, mate, there's so much stuff that we want to talk to you about. But I think my first recollections of you and food and beverage were you used to drink 2 litre bottles of vanilla Coke while you were driving your car home from the coast.
That's where it started.
So is that actually where you found your love for food, was via vanilla Coke?
No, not exactly.
No, let's talk about that though, because I think that when like we knew each other in Canberra, like I guess I had a bit of experience in hospo through Rolls Choice and stuff, which you'd remember.
Great name.
But yeah, I didn't really realise at the time how like that you were into food. So like when you got into your trade, did you have a passion for food before you sort of started?
Was that no, I think I definitely, like I guess it's a common story, but I definitely discovered it at the end of school, you know, going through school and figuring out in those last probably year or two that I wasn't really interested in continuing to study and going to university and finding a career path in another sort of profession. And like so many other chefs, you kind of fall into some sort of dabble in hospitality, whether it's through your school or through, you know, part-time work or something like that. And the notorious hospitality industry just kind of grabs a grip on you, and you become addicted and fall in love with it pretty quickly, and the lifestyle of it. And but I mean, I think like in terms of the passion for food and stuff like that, like I was, you know, I guess I grew up in a family that food was, you know, we did like food, and we did, you know, my parents did cook good food. And so from my whole life, you know, I was always kind of lucky like that, that food was what was important, and we did sort of celebrate it. And so I think that kind of gave me a bit of a starter and a bit of a backbone to actually enjoying it. And you know, having an idea of where I wanted to go with my career earlier as well.
It's funny, it's so interesting because we've talked to so many guests who have that same story where they're like, school was never something that I, like, you know, excelled necessarily or wanted to really go to university and pursue a real professional career in another industry or whatever it might be. And it's like, so the option is, it's like, do a trade.
Mm.
And it's funny because when people choose trades, being a chef is there next to electrician, plumber,
yeah,
you know, carpenter. You kind of choosing which trade you want to do. And you go like, well, I like food. And yeah, you know, you're probably 17 at the time as well. So you're like, well, I like food. Like, and I'm interested like in cooking and things like that. So why not be a chef? But it's just funny how, like, just massive. Like, I mean, the trades are very varied and stuff like that as well. But just how massively different a chef's world is to most of those other trades that you see.
In some ways. Like, I think I'm always trying to get, like, chefs are always sort of as fucking artists all the time. And it's much closer to a trade than what people think.
Mm.
Like, you go to work with your tools. You repeat the job the exact same way, time after time after time. And you go home, maybe for a beer.
Yeah.
That's quite similar.
Yeah.
But I think it's just the reverence that chefs get is better than carpenter. There's no master carpenter on like national TV. You don't get like
Scotty Cam.
Yeah.
The only one.
Yeah. You don't get like, you know, people being like, you know, I've just always wanted to be a carpenter. So I've come on this show to, you know, make my dreams come true. Like, you wouldn't have that. So
yeah.
Chefing has this kind of weird reverence to it.
Well, I think when I started, you know, my career as a chef and started training and stuff like that, it was also a really good time to do it in terms of, you know, there's a lot, you know, cooking shows were really prominent.
Yeah. Mm.
There's definitely some influential chefs around the world that gave a bit of excitement and pride towards it, you know. Mm. Like, I think, like, you know, Jamie Oliver was really big then, and you know, there was a lot of those. It was easier to find influence that heightened it from just a trade and kind of did give it a bit of you know, something special towards it, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, probably wouldn't even, when I was in my teens, it probably hardly even occurred to me that chef was a job.
Yeah.
Until you started seeing like Jamie Oliver would have sort of been big when I was 16, 17, I guess. I mean, it was probably the first times where I was like, realized that chefing was a thing. Not that I had any sort of thought of getting into it for another 6, 7 years, but I think there might be a difference between sort of our generation of when we fell into it with younger people now maybe making it more of a, I want to be a chef from a young age.
Yes.
Very few people before would have been like, ambition is to be a chef. Like you said, it would have fallen into it, been an accident. It would have been, I was doing dishes and I thought it might, you know, may as well be a chef now.
Yeah.
Does, I might have asked a guest this question before, but like, is there any, when you first start your apprenticeship, I didn't obviously do an apprenticeship or anything, but when you first start, do you get sat down and get told what your life's going to look like if you excel as a professional in this industry?
Not really. I mean,
yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, you kind of, yeah, it's interesting.
Like, I think when I started, it wasn't so much. Like, I mean, I started in a good restaurant and had a, you know, really supportive and professional team. And, you know, I think within that, you could see where the career would go.
Right.
But certainly these days we do. Like, yeah, absolutely. Like, when we bring on apprentices or young chefs, we really, you know, we do paint that picture for them of you know, what they're getting into and where they can go with it. Mm. And in the really optimistic way, so that they're thinking about that. I think it's always, you know, I've definitely worked with a lot of chefs, and I've probably myself gone into it naively at times and just sort of gone with it mindlessly, not knowing where I'm going, just doing it without, you know, huge amounts of direction. But I think that's something that's good to do, you know, for younger chefs now, that we sort of do, is really make sure they've got that direction and that they are thinking about where they're going, and that they, you know, do plan ahead for where they want their careers to go, and they kind of map it out a bit more.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, like, as a chef, you kind of have, from when you start till when you get to your late 20s, like, that's the key time to, you kind of need to know where you want to go in those years. Then you can dictate where you're going to work, who you're going to work for, and build towards that goal. So something I've always tried to make sure chefs kind of know, like, I had a goal of, like, I want to do this by the time I'm 30, and in between I'm going to sacrifice friends, money,
yeah.
time, everything else to try and get there.
Mm.
And I'm still sacrificing stuff.
Well, that's it. Time. I mean, like, you've got the lifespan of a chef that, you know, gets to cook on the line and in the, you know, in the kitchen really hands-on every day isn't a long time. It's not a long career. So the earlier you can kind of establish a really good idea of where you want to go or and what you want to do in that kind of that part of your career and who you want to work with or what parts of the world you want to work in, the better you're off, I think. Like having that path and that direction, definitely, like, you know, I guess it just stops being complacent, stops sort of taking the job complacently and and without direction, because there's just so much you can achieve in a relatively short career before you start to have to look into you know, other jobs. You know, when you're a bit older and you can't sort of
keep up with the young and do the long
days on your feet. Yeah.
I wonder, it's interesting because, like, you guys now, right, and your age group, your peers and things 30s. Like that, 30s, are kind of the people that are sort of at the top of the game at the moment in a lot of, you know, dining around Australia. There's some of the old guard still at the top and some younger people coming through now too. But you sort of grew up in a time, like we explained, where, like, a lot of people were making choices to become a chef based on just picking a trade and picking something they were interested in, maybe a bit naive about what they were getting themselves in for, and certainly not, you know, thinking before they even start their apprenticeship or at the very start of their career, this is where I want to take this and this is where I want to end up. But, like, you know, the people who... the generation that are now really interested in food before they even start their profession and, you know, have heard of all the names that they see on social media and they see on MasterChef and they've heard of all these people and they're like, I want to be like that guy, like, and stuff. It'll be interesting to see what that generation comes to be and where once they get to your age and to your level, when they're the head chefs and they're the owners, the younger owners and things like that in the industry and, you know, cities and regional places and stuff, what the industry will look like then, rather than it sort of being a bit of a mix of people who were in it from the start with a real focus and people who sort of just got into it just because and sort of excelled in it because they were a natural or whatever it might be.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and like it'll be super interesting how the industry's like obviously changed now from what it was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, but then also, you know, for another in 10 or 15 years, like what restaurants look like then, what other opportunities and what in which ways the industry actually diversifies and opens up for maybe a broader range of career options within the hospitality industry.
Which
you've already seen happening so much with more media, more sort of you know, like lots and lots of different ways.
Yeah, well, it's interesting with that career direction and stuff. Now it's like there's some famous chefs out there that I'm like I know what restaurants they used to work at and stuff, and now I'm like, I don't even know what they do now, but they're still like really high profile chefs.
I think that's the thing is that, like, I think a lot of chefs are realizing it doesn't have to be restaurant work you do.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be, you know, fast food, like, you know, guys from Butter, we chat to. You know, it can be a deli, it can be a cafe. So I think there's a lot more.
Yeah, or it could be consulting, or it can be writing,
or catering, or whatever it is. I think realistically, you're still, most chefs are hard workers in restaurants, and that's what most of the chefs are. The good ones are hardworking and, you know, can do other things and creative and all those other bits, but a lot of it is just working hard. So a lot of people who maybe go watch MasterChef and like, I want to create these beautiful dishes, the reality of being in a kitchen every day and having to do that for 10 years before you get the chance to actually create is daunting, and that basically weeds a lot of people out. So and that's until we find a way of making restaurant work significantly easier, which realistically there isn't a particular way. There's ways of making it better, but it's never going to be an easy 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's I think it's always going to be that way. So I think that's why you've seen more, you know, private catering and other avenues that chefs are using to you know, be connected to food.
Interesting. It's an interesting, I don't know, it's going to be interesting what the future holds because so much has happened now in the last 12 months that...
I think the next 3 years is going to be the most interesting.
Yeah, really interesting. So, Alan, there's so much we can talk about, but before, I want to get on to when you moved to Melbourne from Canberra and stuff in a second, but just quickly finishing off Canberra, was there like a moment or a place that you worked at in Canberra where it sort of clicked for you that, like, the style of food that you're doing, you know, with the McConnell Group and that top tier type of dining is where you wanted to be, and you were like, this is the type of food I want to be cooking, I want to be working at that level. Was that in Canberra? Did that happen?
Yeah, no, it definitely happened in Canberra, and it happened pretty early in my apprenticeship, I think. So I started my first job as an apprentice, or as a chef, was at a restaurant called the Lobby Restaurant, which is in like the Parliamentary Triangle.
I think it's
Canberra.
Closed now.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Might just do events or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's sort of been like a really kind of, you know, prominent fine dining, really grand restaurant in Canberra for like a long, long time. It had some really influential owners and chefs that had been there probably since the 70s maybe.
Yeah, long time.
And I'd sort of joined that restaurant and started my apprenticeship there right at the end of its sort of period, where it was still, you know, a full a la carte, open every night restaurant that serviced a lot of politicians and a lot of people out for, you know, great meals. And I think entering into a more fine dining restaurant as an apprentice, you know, you get exposed to that world through the people you're working with, and you quickly, you know, you get into it, and you start researching, you start reading, and you start looking at, you know, I guess deciding where you want your career to go and what inspires you. And for me, while I was in Canberra, you know, the obvious thing to look at was all the restaurants in Sydney, and some of the big chefs there that were doing really good things. And that was probably the thing that was, you know, which really popped up in front of my face straight away. And it was very much like, you know, you're looking at the three hat restaurants in Sydney and thinking that's the number one spot you want to be on. And so yeah, for a long time, you know, that was like that's what I aspired to, and that's what kind of drove me to stay in that kind of end of the restaurant industry. And also, I think, you know, just you quickly starting off in a really good restaurant that that's sort of, you know, I guess a really good quality restaurant, it's not only good quality in the face value, it's that trickles down to everything, the way that the staff that work there, all the practices and general things that happen there are just done with more consideration and of a high standard, and that just becomes your life and the way in which you work. And so you then start looking at the next levels of that, and it sort of inspires you to be better, and you start, I guess, doing that classic chef thing where you're in search of perfection.
It's just it's a culture. It's a culture there.
Yeah.
And if you can't, because you're a chef and you have to work alongside other chefs, you know, such long hours every day, that if you guys aren't on the same like page when it comes to how much you appreciate the food and trying to do things properly, then like you'll lose interest, or you won't be good, because like it's like if you don't care, then
it's those little things that start becoming obsessions that you still see it's I guess it's a chefy thing, but it probably happens in other industries as well. But it's just the small things that become obsessions that you just obsess. Yeah. They're the most meaningful things, like the way you wash the dishes or the way you stack pans together, and those little tiny things that
which gastros you like.
It's a mild form of insanity for sure.
it's all habit building.
Yeah,
that just kind of makes a good kitchen. And as all habits, bad habits are bad, hard to break.
Yes,
as well.
Yeah.
So it's instilling. You see, good kitchens will keep getting better and stay good because they've got that culture and those habits in place. So when new staff come in, they just get absorbed into it and you get taken up, and it's like, well, everyone does it. Everyone puts their chucks there and their knife there and their board there. So I have to do the same thing. And it's very easy to build that. And that's why you see good restaurants able to open other restaurants, because they've already got those habits. They take a few chefs over there and it's already built in. And that's some of the harder things to start as a new restaurant.
Definitely. But that's something that people grab to, and like I think, you know, if you're someone who's learning, it gives people direction, and I think that's what people attach themselves to, and they like that. It makes people not feel like they know what to do all the time, and that's something that's good. But yeah, I guess Canberra I had a really good run. Like, you know, I went from doing most of my apprenticeship at the Lobby. I worked at the Water's Edge.
Oh, did you? Restaurant under James? James Moussillon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was before James Moussillon.
Before James.
Yeah, so it was when I think Fiona Wright owned
it. That's right, yeah.
And so there was two chefs that I worked with. Darren Vaughan was the first one, and then Pablo was the second. And these were guys who had come from Sydney, both from Sydney, and they'd brought their Sydney teams to Canberra to work at this restaurant. And they'd all come from three hat restaurants in Sydney. So that then gave me another level of exposure to, you know, a whole step up. In
terms of that was next level for Canberra at the time.
It was. I think it got two hats straight away, and it was just, in terms of just the work we were doing and, you know, everything about the job.
Such
was
a great
just
spot,
like a huge
too.
Step
like beautiful,
up.
Beautiful location, like right on the lake.
Yeah.
Were you there? Do you know if you were there when the first Capital Cookbook was happening? Were you there at that time?
I might have been,
That was like, I remember the Water's Edge before James owned it was featured in Capital Cookbook 1, which was created by my mum in 2004.
Yeah.
And they, like, you know, like with all these books, we're like, I try to say to the chefs, I'm like, please just give us something that people can make at home, you know, like it's like, I know you want to put your best foot forward and stuff like that, but like it has to be something that people can somehow replicate. Anyway, Water's Edge gave us like an assiette of pork with like fucking 20 different like processes and stuff, and it's like trying to like edit that recipe onto one page, like the people he's like, nah.
It's a 3-day process.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty funny.
But that was a really good experience. And then I ended sort of, I like, you know, before I moved to Canada, to Melbourne, sorry, there was a chef that got hired to come into the lobby restaurant, who was a guy, Christian Halberg, who ended up being quite a bit of a mentor in my early days of cooking. He'd come from I think it's the Four Seasons in Dubai or something. So he did this really really established hotel career, and he spent a lot of time working in Europe and stuff. So he'd come on and he bought the whole rest of the world to my kind of life of cooking and opened
a hotel
that up
point
a
of view as well, which is sort of quite different to a restaurant as it were.
It was, but it was still that kind of that real high end hotel. So the food that he was doing was, you know, the food that we did there was still, you know, really heavily European influenced, but really refined and quite classic, lots of French, sort of classic French roots to it. So that was really awesome as well. And he ended up opening a restaurant called Pulp Kitchen in Ainslie, which I think now is called Pilot.
Yeah, it's Pilot.
And so we
the Canberra history here.
Yeah,
we'd sort of taken that spot over, and he asked me to kind of do it with him, you know, to be his sort of sous chef.
Yeah,
and I think I was still like right at the end of my apprenticeship.
Yeah,
when he asked me to do this. I was pretty young, but I'd formed like a pretty strong, you know, really really strong working relationship with him, and he was definitely sort of mentoring me through that part of my career. And I think I was probably there for about 2 years for the first couple of years of Pulp Kitchen opening. That was just an awesome experience as well, and just a really fun experience opening a restaurant and then seeing something like that happen on a completely different budget scale that was obviously a lower sort of very very, you know, bricks and mortar. And you know, the restaurant was also a big step away from that fine dining as well. It was very bistro, bistro-esque, and
it was so cool.
A lot
it was
more
such
relaxed,
a good restaurant.
But yeah, it was just a very fun, a really good time to be there as well. I think all restaurant openings are similar like that. The first year or so, there's always a lot of spontaneity and a lot of just, they're just a bit freer, and it's that time when they form themselves. And those first few couple of years at Pulp Kitchen were just amazing, like that. It was so much fun and learned a lot. Got, you know, stepping away from the more kind of fine dining sort of food was a lot of fun as well, and it really opened my eyes up to, you know, the achieving flavor through simplicity and ingredients rather than technique and multiple millions of things on plates and stuff like that, which was really nice. And also opened my eyes to the other side. It was the first sort of open kitchen I'd worked in, so seeing, you know, working in a dining room and seeing guests and, you know, talking and having conversations with guests and, you know, seeing how the front of house worked was awesome as well. So that kind of really, you know, got a lot out of that for sure.
I think that was such a cool restaurant, and I remember going, I went in a few times when you were cooking and stuff, and it was a kind of a new thing for suburban shops in Canberra as well. Like there was a few restaurants out in the shops and stuff like that, but it was kind of like a new kind of level of dining for your sort of suburban shops. You always had your kind of local Italians and things like that, but then in the Ainslie shops there, when Pulp Kitchen opened up, I remember going in and I was like, yeah, you don't get food like this at the shops. Like,
yeah,
you know,
it's just a gentrification of like suburban restaurant, I think, which is always exciting, you know, and it's always exciting to see when you, you know, you see that here in Melbourne, in Carlton and things like that now, where you people are opening up literally the same restaurant that, you know, restaurants like the Carlton Wine Room and Capitano and stuff.
Yeah,
I had a Capitano last week and we look at the menu and it could be the same as any other Italian restaurant on Lygon Street that's this cheesy old Italian restaurant that's, you know, loads of tourists and stuff, is a big tourist attraction, but it's just it's a fresh view on it, and it's awesome. It's super tasty, and you just like, this food is great.
We're going to try to get there while we're here.
Timeless. Yeah. Timeless food is, and timeless restaurants are always great.
Yeah. So. I have to correct myself, by the way. Aubergine was another suburban restaurant in Canberra that has always sort of like been amazing. So that's another one of the shops that was around for a very long time too. But I think Pop Kitchen in its sort of bistro approach and stuff for that sort of casual meal, not necessarily a fine diner, that sort of weekly go-to.
Yeah.
It was different. Yeah, I remember like our weekly go-to places as a family were very much just like, there were these big menus with like, you'd have your steak, you'd have like your pastas, you'd have a few pizzas, you'd
three
have
steaks, two pastas,
your salt in bocca, your, you know, your cordon bleu, like bits and pieces like that. And that was
French. Nice.
That was your sort of, that was your thing. But yeah, it was a different level when your Pulp opened up. All right, let's get on to Melbourne. Where was the first place you worked when you moved down?
So I had a really good friend who kind of got me in. Yeah, it's a bit of an inspiration for getting into chefing as well. He was sort of a year ahead of me, I think, at school, and he started his apprenticeship. I think he left school a bit early, like, you know, when he was 16, and started cooking, and we were, you know, still remained friends. And I was just like, wow, that's amazing. I thought it was, you know, that's what probably another big influence of why I got into it, was kind of following him into this career. And he moved to Melbourne, and I came down and visited him, and just when I was cooking in Canberra, and just my original plans were to move to Sydney, which was obviously quite a kind of typical transition from chefs in New South Wales or the ACT, is to go to, you know, the city in Sydney and kind of cook there. But I ended up just spending a week, I think, with him in Melbourne, and he was showing me around and eating at the restaurants that he was working at, and just absorbing the city a bit, and just really, really liked it. I just found it really friendly, and I remember walking down the street and people would just, strangers would just say hello to you when they walked past. And I was like, wow, this is what a nice place. Yeah. So I was like, yeah. He was working in a restaurant called Com, which was in the city in Alfred Place. And he, basically got me in into working there. And I was working with a chef. I think it was owned by the Van Handels and working with a chef, Simon Arklis, is a British chef who'd, again, sort of a British expat who'd come out to Melbourne in that sort of that, I think they call it the Brit Pack, he was sort of part of that. So he'd bought this whole classic British cooking, and it was really good.
I think
he was running the Oxo Towers in London?
Right, yeah.
And with his wife, Kate, and they'd come to Melbourne and were running Com, and that was my first job. It was unreal. It just went from, you know, I guess what we were doing in Canberra to going to this kitchen and breaking down whole lambs and whole suffering pigs, and just like the level again was just another big step up. And it had come from, you know, classically British, trained British cooking, and that was just like, I just kind of hit the ground running with that, and it was amazing. Yeah, and like just one of the best, most friendliest teams I've ever had. Like, still super close friends with a lot of the people we're working with then. And
that's awesome.
it was awesome. It was just like the perfect restaurant to enter Melbourne with, and just the, you know, I think it had a chef's hat at the time, and it was I guess it was, yeah, just a really good restaurant to learn how to cook in Melbourne and what people were cooking at the time. I think, you know, like still that sort of Spanish flavors were still really prominent. I know that like Humulus had opened that year as well, so
yeah,
there was a lot of buzz into that sort of a bit more relaxed kind of dining. Yeah, it was great. Awesome.
And then, so from there, when did you, like, because I think we will spend a lot of time talking about your work for Andrew and the McConnell Group.
Yeah.
So what was your first job with the McConnell Group?
So I'd started working for Andrew at Cutler & Co. when it first opened.
Right.
I think it was in 2009.
Right.
I think.
When it first opened. Yeah, right. Yeah. And so that was when it was
like a month after it opened the doors, which was like in January, I think. And yeah, that was a huge experience. Like,
right.
The first
fine dining kind of been at the top level at that time, right?
Yeah, and just a really ambitious restaurant to open. It was sort of, I think, like all of Andrew's restaurants, when he opens something, it does, you know, it is something new. It's and in multiple different layers. It was always something new. He and Cutler & Co. was certainly that. It was certainly that. It was a very cool restaurant at the time.
Yeah.
It was. It was a crazy experience.
Yeah.
It was super, super intense. Working there for that restaurant when it opened. Amazing people to work with, like some of the chefs that have sort of been in there in that first sort of year and 2 years, you know, where they've gone is pretty awesome. So yeah, but it was a huge eye opener for me. It was sort of just, again, another progression in my career, but just it was a big step up going from that sort of one hat level into the next step up, but also in a new restaurant that quickly became just the hottest ticket in town,
yeah,
or even in the country. It was, yeah, it was a hard to keep up with it.
You had three hats for a number of years, right?
I don't think we got three. I think it always sort of got two, you know, maybe probably in the first year that it opened, and then it's just kind of stayed at that level the whole time.
Okay.
And I think it's celebrated 10 years, like a year ago or something.
Yeah.
Sort of, it's now 10 or 11 years
after
old.
After all sorts of iterations and,
yeah,
and
a couple
structural
of,
changes and
yeah,
things like that.
Yeah.
So how long did you sort of stay there right through for a while, or did you kind of move
around?
No, so
my first, I've had a few stints there and a few stints working with Andrew, so I kind of keep going back with
it. So let's, hold on, we'll start with every of which all the venues you've worked at in the McConnell Group, and then we'll sort of, we don't have to go, we don't have to talk about your experience at each one.
Yeah.
But you've been head chef at, you open Marion?
Yep. Yeah, I was the first chef and did the opening and put that together.
And then... You were also head chef at Cutler & Co. for a time?
Yep.
And Super Normal?
No. So I've spent most of my year, I think I've spent probably about 8 years total working at Cutler & Co.
Okay.
And I'd sort of gone from a junior chef, a commis chef, from chef to party, and kind of all the way up to head chef over that time. I briefly got out of Cutler & Co. and did Marion, which was amazing. I loved Marion, and I still do, and it was such a good thing to put together. But only really got to cook there for about, I think it was like 6 months.
Yeah, okay.
So I got to do the opening, got to set it up, got it established, and then got pulled back into Cutler. Now, but for good reasons. I was, you know, got offered the sort of the head chef role back at Cutler & Co. and spent, I think it was like 2, 3, or 4 years as the head chef. And then from there I went into a development chef role for the group.
Yeah.
For I think it was about a year and a half. Which was awesome. That sort of, I got to then sort of spend a bit more time in the other kitchens around the group. So Super Normal Canteen at the time, the Builder's Arms Hotel, Cumulus. I think at the time as well, then, you know, when I was in that role, Andrew was doing a lot, he was doing quite a lot of cooking outside of the restaurant, so a lot of food events, a lot of stuff for publication, for papers and magazines and stuff like that. So a lot of my role out was almost like putting that sort of stuff together, a lot of photo shoots, a lot of sort of one-off events and things like that. So that was super interesting. Every day was different.
Was that on
different places?
Did you Was that a bit of a breather from the slog of a head chef role
at a hands-on? It was a little bit, but I sort of didn't end up doing it for that. I sort of quickly discovered there's two things I really missed when I was in that role, and one was having a team to work with and being in charge, leading a team.
Yeah.
And I really missed doing services and just the general charms of working in a restaurant. And I also just realized I was probably just a bit young for it. I sort of didn't really want that in my life at the time. And I was like, I'd love this job in 10 years time when I'm 40 years old and I want to, you know, have nights off and slow things down a bit more. I really enjoyed it, and there were some amazing things we did and amazing places we cooked and things like that. But, I really kind of just missed being in the actual restaurant, kind of.
Yeah, it's like it's nice addicted. To do. It's nice to do different things and do outside catering. And like I end up taking up quite a lot of it when I get offered things. But then afterwards, I'm like, oh, I like the kitchen. I do them sporadically, but I can never imagine being a full time caterer. Like every weekend, being like, well, fuck, we're cooking here now.
Yeah,
what we're gonna do here. Like it's his own weird kind of grind.
It is,
and like the consistency and the kind of reliability of just being in an actual kitchen is quite comforting.
Yeah,
as manic as it can be.
Well, it's just super hard work. It's just really taxing as well, because every event you do, like you said, it's just every event's different. They're all kind of bespoke, and they're all in a different state or somewhere else around the world, and you're just like, it's just such hard work. By the end of every one, you're just exhausted. Yeah. Where I think, you know, working in a kitchen with a team, you've got the support of a team, you're working in a team, and you quickly, you know, I think I quickly realized, okay, I'm a team player, not, you know, I'm not a, you know, individual here. I love having the support of a team and bouncing things off a team and having a team involved in the work that I'm doing and achieving the goals or just achieving, you know, good things in a team rather than by yourself. So, it was a bit of a realization there, and it's definitely something like I'd love to go back to and stuff. But, I think it probably is something that's good to tie in to when you do want to actually step out of the kitchen, or when your body's telling you to step out of the kitchen,
one of the options we were talking about earlier.
Sort of the next kind of, it could be it's next a next phase. Sort of phase in a career, I think.
And obviously, like, I mean, we went and had a drink at Gimlet last night and had some beautiful food as well. And so you've opened that recently and are working as head chef at Gimlet, which we'll get into detail in a sec about what you're doing there, because we want to talk about it's such a beautiful venue and the food's amazing from what we've had so far. But we're going for the full experience tomorrow night, which we're very much looking forward to.
Yeah.
But let's talk a bit about... Oh, and also it's worth mentioning... that you did, you also sort of, before opening Gimlet, you did a stint as head chef at Lesser as well.
So I think after kind of spending, did a long stint with Andrew through Cutler and then into that development role. And by the end of that, I sort of, you know, I felt like I'd sort of reached as far as I wanted to reach with Andrew, and it wasn't, you know, I guess I sort of was like, well, I need to change it up. You know, I need to learn from someone else. I need to have some different experiences and see how some different people run their shops, and just change things up a bit to, you know, hopefully find some more direction for myself. And I sort of stepped away, had a little bit of time off, traveled a little bit, and then kind of came back to Melbourne and was basically looking for a job where it was just really currently like focused on food, and you know, probably in somewhere a little bit of a smaller restaurant group, and someone that was just, you know, super highly creative and really individual and stuff like that. And so there was a couple of options I was looking at, but ended up falling into a spot with Dave Verhul at Embler, and he was about to open up Lesser, so it was sort of quickly going into a two venue location. So it was sort of agreed to do like a small stint with him, just had an awesome time. Working with Dave was like just everything I kind of wanted out of that experience. Like he's a genius with food. His palate is just so insanely good and focused, and he's very creative. He's always thinking out of the box and doing something different and interesting. And there's just a lot to learn working with him, cooking over, you know, Ambler especially, you know, that kitchen pretty much primarily just cooks over fire.
Mm.
And it's a busy, busy wine bar that really pumps. So it's like it's an electric vibe cooking in that kitchen.
Yeah,
you're cooking, you know, you can only fit four people in the kitchen and it's at a tight squeeze and it's just, it's like, it's wild. It's a wild place to work and a lot of fun. So yeah, it was just a really nice contrast working from, you know, with Andrew and his restaurant group to this small, what was almost like a family vibe field run restaurant. And just, it was just really food focused, lots of fun, lots of partying, lots of really great friendships built there. It was wild. So it was a real refreshing break from a pretty, like, you know, pretty senior role in a pretty big restaurant group where you had a lot of responsibility, a lot of, you know, it wasn't just about the food. You're also managing the business side of the kitchen with its finances and its HR and everything. So, you know, they're big roles, those jobs. And you know, not to say that Ambler and Lesser didn't involve that at all. It was just on a much smaller scale. And just, you know, there was just the dial was turned down a bit there, which was nice. So it was very much focused on the food. And then with Lesser, opening up Lesser, that was sort of, you know, the just, again, on top of that, the creativeness and stuff that went into that was amazing.
And just being able to just cook, just focus on sort of cooking, learning things and cooking new food. What was the, like, how was the sort of creative collaboration like with Dave? Because obviously he's the creative mind behind Lesser and Ambler.
Yeah.
And, you know, you coming in there from having worked, you know, predominantly for the last period under Andrew, was there like opportunities for you to inject your creativity into the menus and
absolutely
that sort of thing?
Dave was really, really generous with that. I didn't know Dave really, really well before I started working there. I'd sort of, you know, he'd come in and had eaten at Marianne and we'd sort of introduced ourselves a few times before, but I didn't know him. I didn't actually really know him apart from his food and his sort of his restaurant identity more, but he was, we sort of clicked really, really quickly, really, really well. And he, straight away put a huge amount of trust in me and very much involved me in the you know, the creative process with the food, both at Ambler and Lesser. He, you know, I think he was at that stage where he was trying to, you know, wanting to step out of just being in the kitchen all the time as well. So he obviously led a lot of the day-to-day stuff and running of the kitchen with me, which was great. But yeah, definitely I had a huge amount of input on what happened on the menus.
What's going through your mind when you're trying to create something for a restaurant like that? And you're like, how do I, like, how do you fit I don't know what it is. It's like channeling what is the essence of the food style at Ambler and Lesser, which is, as you said, it's like super creative, really
it is,
unique.
Yeah.
And like, you're thinking, does this fit? Like, does this work?
I think we quickly established, and it was really funny because I think both me and Dave sort of established this kind of ideology at the same time, was when we were sort of coming up with an idea for a dish, we'd have an idea of what we wanted the raw structure of this dish to be. So it might be like a raw fish dish for Ambler or something like that. And you quickly come up with like five ideas off the top of your head they're all ideas you've done before or that you've seen before or you've been influenced by some way. And we made it really, we sort of set this rule that, you know, those first five ideas you had to scrap because they're just completely influenced from something else. And you needed to kind of take it back and then really think about it and come up with something different.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, put something different into it, put a different flavor into it, just sort of play with it a bit more to make it a bit more individual, a bit more interesting, and a bit more left of field. I think, you know, Dave's pantry at Ambler's and Lesser was amazing as well. He's sort of really into, you know, a lot of, you know, they had pretty strict rules from when they opened about, you know, everything was done from scratch. So really great place for that. So there was a lot of preserving, a lot of fermenting. You know, and I think working with him, that was one of the big things I learned. And because he'd been playing around with that sort of stuff before, it was cool, I guess.
Yeah.
But you know, they were really dabbling with a lot of that stuff before at the Town Mouse, which was his restaurant before. So he'd had he'd had this sort of like 5 years, 10 years of actual experience in it. He'd sort of been he'd already made all the mistakes with it. Yeah. So that was a really awesome opportunity to learn how to do those things really well and really properly. Mm. And it just kind of gave us this pantry of flavors and different things to play with that no one else had.
I think that's when people who aren't chefs talk about creating, they think there's sort of a dish happens and it's you put these ingredients together where you don't really think in ingredients, you think about in flavors. So you think about acid, you know, temperature, texture, bitterness, saltiness, all these things, and you create a dish that way because you know it's got to have these elements. The ingredients don't really matter as long as they fit into that sphere. Mm. So once you go, we need a raw fish dish.
Yeah.
You go, right, well, which fish we're going to use? What have we seen? Like, how are we going to technique that? And then you build flavors, and especially if you've got a pantry of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, right, we need some acid. Like, where's that coming from? It's coming from here. We need texture. So it's not really... It's not really, your, like, I find myself anyway, it's never ingredients. Or it might start with an ingredient, but then it's built up through flavors and textures.
Yeah, definitely. Than
being like, you know, it's going to be...
Well, that's exactly how it works. You know, instead of, yeah, like you'd so, you know, you'd have a, you'd go, I want a clean white, like a clean, clean lean fish, or I want a fatty, rich fish. And then you go, okay, cool. So then it needs either something fatty or something less fatty. Mm-hmm. And you need... You know, that fat might not come from like creme fraiche or cream or something like that, or mayonnaise. Like, it might come from, you know, nuts or something like that, and or seeds, you know, and you might make like a puree or a milk or something out of seeds. And then you go, okay, so I need some acid and salt. And instead of using like lemon juice, you might go, I'm going to use like green olive brine or something that you taste like all the time, but you don't think of as necessarily like an ingredient.
Yeah,
it's just so... It's kind of in front of your face the whole time, but it always passes over your head.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're thinking about what you've got.
The juice from pickled onions.
Yeah.
It's just like the best seasoning.
Oh, it's delicious.
Like, I end up like having in, like at home, just like jars of juiceless
pickled onions. Yeah, you never throw that out.
Chucking that in sauces.
Yeah, yeah, that's the best part. I always find that like, you know, with meat, with cooking things on with meat and something else, like if you cook meat over rice or fish over rice, the best part of the meal is actually the rice and all the flavor that comes from the meat in the rice. You actually don't need the meat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's sort of, it's yeah, that's funny.
That's interesting. Yeah. I think that that approach, and it sort of makes so much sense as to the originality of the food at Embler and Lesser and the way that Dave's built himself like into the chef that he is. I think that like he occupies a position with a lot of people who are in hospitality that are like, if you go to Melbourne, you have to go to one of those venues and just check out what they're doing, because it's always going to be innovative. It's always going to be interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
And to set a ground rule that's chuck away your first five ideas because they're going to be adulterated by Instagram and, you know, a food show you might have watched the other day or a chef that you worked with before here
is such a
like, it's... You're immediately setting yourself up for a big challenge because you can't fall back on something that you used to or easily, like that just comes easy.
Yeah.
And you're forced to innovate.
I think with creativity, so cool. I think like Ferran Adria had the best definition of creativity, and it was like not copying.
Yeah.
like simple. Two words. And then that's what it is. Like there's, and then there's levels of creativity. If you want to be truly creative, you have to not copy dishes. And that's why I said, like, if you think about flavors and layers to a dish, you can actually like create your own thing
by row
that way. If you're thinking about ingredients, you're obviously going to copy other people because you're looking at what's been done before and what goes together.
Yeah, most certainly. It's one of those things. I mean, it's one of those things. Like the more you challenge yourself with a creative idea, and the more you sort of squeeze out of your brain to push past the obvious, the more individual and sometimes hopefully the better it's going to be. But certainly the more individual it's going to be. And I think when you see any chefs doing anything that stands out, if it's a, you know, with an ingredient or if it's a dish or something like that, it's always those, you always look at them and you're like, oh, it's so obvious. You know, and why haven't I thought of that? It's because you haven't, you know, I guess you just haven't pushed your brain as hard as they have to really kind of think about it.
So we're at the point now where you've been working at Lesser and Embler for a while, and
you've been around the traps.
You've seen some things, and I think Gimlet is probably like the biggest Melbourne opening of 2020, and you know, a lot of anticipation behind it and stuff like that, and you were kind of there every step of the way.
Yeah.
I don't even know where we start. Do you want to tell us a bit about the first conversations with Andrew?
Yeah, definitely. Well, so yeah, like I sort of said, when I was, you know, I'd sort of done this agreement with Dave where it was sort of not going to be a long-term thing, you know, there was, you know, in terms of, you know, my career with him, and I sort of done, you know, sort of was coming up to 2 years with him, and the timing kind of worked out really well where I was starting to look at, you know, 6 months down the track, I was like, what am I going to do? Am I going to stay with Dave, or I'm going to, you know, make another move and see what happens next? And so that sort of timing worked out really well where they, you know, Chris Handle, who's the group sort of GM, and Andrew both approached me and said, you know, we've signed a lease on this new venue in the city and we want you to have a look at it, and we want you to run it. We want you to be the head chef. And it was pretty awesome because I sort of knew that them at that stage, they could really, you know, and for this venue, they could have sort of offered that to anyone in Australia. It's a pretty, pretty awesome opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I was very humbled to sort of be the first one off the rank to get offered that. And, you know, it was obviously a pretty substantial, important, you know, job offer.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they took me into, you know, we met at on the site, which was previously better, like, it's a Bang & Olufsen showroom.
Yeah.
So on the corner of Flinders Lane and Russell Street, and walked in. It was sort of this cleaned out showroom, so there was nothing really in it, but it was, you know, it was just the bare bones of this building and this room. And you walked into this room and it was just so obvious what it was meant to be from the second you walked in there. So it's an older building. I think it was built right at the end of the 1920s in Melbourne. It's an apartment building, actually. It always has been, but the ground floor on it was always, you know, meant to be for, I guess, the public. And for most of its life, it's just been a retail shop. And so this is Gimlet's the first restaurant to ever go into this site. But the bare bones of this room were just like, you could almost picture a full restaurant and what it would look like, what the food would look like.
Like the lower half of buildings that aren't built like that now, with those tall ceilings and like just the space to it.
No, not exactly. It was a grand room.
It was a showroom for a audio company.
Totally. And that's what's awesome about older buildings in all cities, you know, like there's definitely a beauty to them. There's like the quality of them and just the history of them. You feel that when you walk into them. And it's very, very strong and evident with the site at Gimlet. So, yeah, you could literally walk in there with this empty room and almost picture this restaurant and what it down to, like, what sort of tableware you'd use and what the waiters would be wearing. And
which,
like,
is fucking beautiful, by the way. Some of the stuff you guys have in there is
And it's so rare because I sometimes go into restaurants, especially newer buildings, and you just think, how the hell do you know, interior designers and architects come up with something really and often they don't, but they come up with something really original and something really, really creative when you've just got like a proper blank canvas with no personality.
The building's not giving you any cues or anything.
Yeah. So to walk into a space where it's just like, this is what I want to be, it's just like, it's awesome. So the ideas around Gimlet and what it was going to become formed really quickly and established really, really quickly. I think Andrew's really lucky. He gets to travel around a lot and obviously he's had a lot of experience. But he definitely takes, you know, a lot of inspiration from traveling and other restaurants and buildings and art and architecture and things like that from around the world. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, this, you know, it's quite evident that it's very reminiscent of something you might see in London or New York. It very much has that European vibe to it. And so, yeah, it was relatively easy to kind of put together the idea of what we're going to do. And, you know, I think we all, you know, it was a very easy to collaborate as a team as well doing that because we all had the same idea.
Did you get to put a bit into the kitchen design?
Yeah, definitely a little bit. We had Chris Young. He's a kitchen designer who he did the kitchen founder at Supernormal, which is one of the most impressively designed kitchens, I think, that I've ever worked in. and the way it functions and stuff's, you know, really amazing, especially, you know, a high volume restaurant.
Yeah.
He was sort of signed on to do the design of it and to sort of oversee the build of it and stuff like that. But in terms of the layout of it, in terms of the functionality of it, you know, where do you put the oven? Where do you put the grill? Where do you put the stove? Where do you that? We, you know, I was definitely involved in that sort of
Cool.
That sort of thing. And
yeah, I'd love that.
I think it's an opportunity a lot of chefs like would you know, rub their hands together to have in their career is to like, because they were like, a lot of the time you just kind of walk into a kitchen.
Kitchens aren't designed by a chef, and you can tell.
Yeah,
like, but it's also, I mean, that's one of the awesome things we're doing with Andrew is because he's a chef and he's had, you know, years and years of experience of not only cooking kitchens but opening kitchens and designing them and stuff like that. He's pretty good at it.
Yeah, so he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, you've got some pretty good team to work within. Yeah. And you know, I think a lot of the things that you don't probably think about when you're designing those things, like how busy you are going to be and how the kitchen will hold up in terms of functionality.
Yeah, and how
space
many people you got, what sections you got.
Clear ways. Yeah, so there's all those little things that, you know, I definitely didn't have too much bearing on my shoulders in terms of those decisions to make, which was good, but definitely had, you know, the opportunity to have input and,
yeah, that's cool.
And to, you know, put my ideas forth on what I thought was
going to work.
Yeah.
You know, well, you got to use the thing.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. But I'm so far so good.
What about first conversations about menu and stuff like that? Because like having had some food there yesterday afternoon, like it's perfect. Like if you walked into a space like that but didn't look at the menu, you'd almost guess, like you'd be like, this is the perfect menu to match the surroundings.
It's very congruent. So I imagine knowing the identity of the space led to knowing some of the dishes.
Well, that's exactly right. Like I said, from that first moment you walked into that building before it was a restaurant, when it was an empty space, you literally could see the food on the plates and what it would look like. And I think we sort of conceptualized what we... You know, that's also quite a broad thing as well, because it's quite a classic restaurant. It's not a modern restaurant in any way. It's a restaurant that looks back at history and nostalgia, I think, in terms of that, when you think about what's a defining restaurant that you... gives you that warm feeling. It's often the first really great restaurant you go to when you're a child or something like that. That it you kind of those are probably the things that drive the inspiration for it a little bit. And we sort of thought, well, obviously the food's not going to be modern. It's going to be classic. It's going to look back at classic cooking and classic recipes and look back in terms of what we're going to do to go forward. You know, we also really needed to consider what our other restaurants are doing in the group as well. So, you know, opening another restaurant on Flinders Lane, so it's three restaurants within probably 200 metres of each other, and all three big restaurants that are really busy. We're very conscious not to tread on the toes of each other.
Yeah. Was it always intended to be just as much a bar as it is a restaurant?
Definitely, yeah. So the bar, the concept with the bar and the cocktails was from day one. That was definitely on the cards. And I think that was one of the, probably the first part of the restaurant was something we were going to offer that was different to all the other restaurants we had. It was just a really strong cocktail focused bar that's at a really, really high level. So that was definitely part of the concept from day one. And obviously as well, just matches that building. Classic cocktail bar.
It just fits in. It's
so
beautiful.
Well.
Yeah,
like that grand space makes you happy to spend $25 on a martini.
Yeah,
like totally. Like it just gives the whole place value when you're in that space.
Yeah, and that's something that like cooking there. I think I've realized and not necessarily realized in other jobs before was that it is the sum of all its parts, that restaurant. Yeah. The experience is truly the sum of every aspect of that restaurant. It is the obviously the environment and the design and the quality of the fittings and everything like that, to the curation of the glassware, the tableware, the artwork, and then it's the drinks, the bar, the detail these guys do with the drinks is insane. It's pedantic about the temperature of glasses and the ice, and the everything. And then it's the service, and then it's the food. So it's sort of that was really cool, and that's something I really liked. And it's actually taken the pressure off me as a chef to go, it's not all on my shoulders.
Does that still satisfy you as a chef when it's not all about the food you're putting out?
It does,
everything else?
Absolutely. Well, it takes a whole lot of pressure off. Feel like everyone's there to just come in and judge your food.
Yeah.
You know? It's like people are there to just like have the whole experience, and the role you play in that is very, you know, it's one part of it. It's not the whole part. Mm. And it's also, I guess that's what drives the food as well. It takes it away from trying to create the next biggest dish in the world that's, you know, all over Instagram or that everyone's talking about. It's just really simply about being really delicious and comforting and generous and warm and making you feel good in that environment rather than trying to challenge you or to make you think or to, you know, impress you to the point where that your focus and your time in that restaurant spent actually on the food rather than with everything, and most importantly with the people you're dining with or drinking with.
Yeah, it's such a great atmosphere. I think one of the things that makes Andrew stand out and what he's been able to do from my experience is build these venues that can be used in so many different ways. Like you can walk into Gimlet like we did yesterday afternoon after having had a lunch at Q. For those out there, by the way, just to tell you what we did yesterday, like we went to lunch at Cumulus at 2 o'clock because Simon's never been there. And then we walked into Gimlet and we sat down and Alan just crushed us with appetizers and stuff.
This is after we landed, we couldn't check in here till 2. I did some shopping.
You did some shopping.
And then we went straight into lunch and then a pre-dinner dinner. Yeah. With my bags in tow. I got changed on the street.
Yeah.
In my plane.
Yeah, because we couldn't check in. And then, but yeah, so like, oh, it was just amazing. It was one of those afternoons where like, you're just so happy because we just had beautiful drinks to sit in Gimlet there on a cold Melbourne Sunday afternoon and to have drinks and have those sort of food, like you're just all warm, you're full, but like enjoying yourself. And we came back to drop our bags off and have like the briefest of little breathers, and then we went straight to Carlton Wine Room where we had the fucking tasting menu as well. Got the whole works there too, which was fantastic. But that's an aside. It's a big day, but that's what we're here for, you know what I mean? That's what you do when you travel as a hospo
food fight on tour.
That's the thing. Yeah, like what Andrew's been able to do to, and I think Cumulus was the first, expression of that, was to build somewhere where like there's no judgment as to how the customers use this space. It's like the staff want you there in whatever capacity. Like if you want to sit there and have a glass of wine and sit there for, you know, an hour and chat over a glass of wine, like you're not going to feel as if you're not welcome because you're sitting there for too long. And it's the same at Cumulus. It's like you can be having a coffee in the afternoon on your laptop, sending emails and things like that, and sit there for an hour right next to people who are having, you know, 10 different dishes and 3 bottles of wine, and you always feel welcome.
Yeah.
And to be able to create venues that have that welcoming feel and are a space that can be used in so many different ways. And I suppose with Gimlet, like you've got another whole journey to go on as to what you do in the mornings and things like that, which we were discussing earlier and stuff like that too. But it's a really beautiful and really unique thing. And I think that's one of the things that I've always noticed about the McConnell venues is, and it goes to what you're saying about that attention to detail across all the parts of an establishment is just the feeling, the feeling of welcome and the feeling of being relaxed, being welcome. The people that serve you are happy that you're there.
Yeah.
And obviously the food and wine sort of goes there and matches it every step of the way.
I guess the mentality of our group and what we train our teams for is those basic hospitality pledges that you want to feel when you go into a restaurant. And we do work really hard at that. And there's a lot of work that goes into that. There's a lot of work that goes into those little details to the solo diner that we can offer half portions of everything for, and so that they can have more and they can feel like that. And ultimately for us, that builds our client base. It builds our customers who keep coming back over and over again because they feel comfortable and they can use the space for different occasions with different people in different ways. And it also keeps our job interesting as well. It's really nice to like look after someone who's just coming in for one snack and a glass of wine for half an hour really, really well, to give them a half an hour, you know, the best half an hour that they can have. You know, and it's not just all about the people who come in and spending huge amounts of money with big tables and things like that. It makes our job interesting as well. And it's also, there's a lot of reward and a lot of pride that goes into looking after the solo diner or the table of two that have come in from, you know, outside of the city, who it's just a big deal. Just giving the consistent focus and consistent quality of hospitality to anyone in any circumstance just gives you a huge reward for sure. Definitely.
The mix of people there yesterday afternoon, I was quite impressed. You don't see that sort of mix of like, you know, two young girls at the bar, a bunch of hospo dickheads in a booth, some like older people, some people on dates, some like people who just finished work. There was like a really good mix there. Or probably not just Sunday, probably didn't finish work. They was wearing suits. Too many in a suit just worked. But I mean, and that's kind of what everyone, especially now, is looking at, is like, how do you get as much utility out of your space as possible?
Yeah, definitely.
So I mean, very ahead of his time in that sense with all the venues.
Well, especially for a venue that's, you know, it's a pretty bougie grand venue. Like, you know, you walk in there and it's, a lot of people said that, well, it's a venue you walk in and you just want to spend money. you just want to open your wallet. Which is quite a powerful feeling to feel when you walk into a restaurant. But it is really, really awesome that the variety and that it is comfortable and approachable for a whole lot of different people. And I think that, you know, it's hard to do, and especially in a restaurant like that, especially in a restaurant with that sort of feeling and vibe to it, it definitely can be really easy for it to feel uncomfortable or intimidating.
Well, that's the thing. That's what's the awesome thing about it.
But I think having the bar and being able to offer something really relaxed and casual, not just the full dining experience every time, is why that works, because you can come in and just have a really chilled out experience
it doesn't have any sort of feeling of pretension or unwelcome. Like I would feel comfortable walking in a pair of shorts and having a quick drink with a friend or whatever. And it's funny that you said that's the place you want to spend money at, because the girl who served us last night at Carlton Wine Room was like, oh, you went to Gimlet this afternoon. I just lose hours in that place. I go there to have one cocktail with a friend, and 3 hours later, I've eaten a steak and drank a full bottle of red. You know what I mean?
And in the end of the day, like, this is what you'd need. Like, you're here to make money.
Yeah.
And so you want as many people to be able to come in as possible.
Yeah, definitely.
You want
people
to come in at all times of the day and at all price points.
That's exactly right.
You're constantly making bank.
Yeah.
And that's the, you can't stay open unless you do that.
Yeah, definitely. I think being open to that idea and just realizing, you know, like the more you're open and the more you're open for people to come in and just come in and buy things. That's how you make the money. It's sort of restricting your services and stuff. I mean, obviously for some people it works that way and you know, with different sort of limitations and stuff, but you know, definitely in the middle of the city where you've got the population and that foot traffic and theatres and things like that, and obviously that's all, you know, that's starting to come back after last year. And yeah, I mean, that's why you come in on a Sunday afternoon and it's full.
Briefly before we finish, let's talk a bit about the food. Obviously, like we touched on it before, very European, very classic, very, you know, simple. What's it like? Tell us about how you source, you know, your produce. And because obviously when you're creating food that's classic and simple, but at a high quality establishment, it allows you to be able to just find the best shit, basically. Is that what you're kind of doing at the moment?
Definitely. Like, I think that with the food, that's kind of one of the underlining rules with, and it was not really a rule, but it's the thing that I've established quick with working with him for so long, is that that's where a lot of the hard work as a chef or a head chef is actually sourcing ingredients and sourcing the best ingredients. Like, that's probably what I spend most of my time doing, is just talking to suppliers, trying to get better ingredients, trying to get the new ingredients, trying to see what else out there, you know, keep digging, because there's so much good stuff around, yeah. as we know. And it's, especially in the middle of the city, it's hard. You're not, it's not right in front of your face. You've really got to like get on the phone or get on the internet and find it and talk to people and stuff like that. And it's a lot about, it's a lot of networking. It's a lot of conversation. So yeah, we, you know, I guess the concept of kind of classic timeless food is part of what sort of, outlines what the menu is going to be and what the food is going to be. But what takes it from being, you know, French food in the 1980s to food now is definitely the produce that we use. So we, you know, in the restaurant group, in the Trader House restaurant group, part of that, obviously we have a butchery, Meatsmith, which is awesome. They specialize in local rare breed poultry, you know, meat, pork, so that's awesome. And obviously being part of that, you know, being an arm of the being part in the same group, we do have insides to to sourcing what we want. They work really hard for us to get us what we want, and we try and do the best with it as well, so that's really awesome. We work with quite a lot of biodynamic farmers as well. That sort of, one of the really nice things about Melbourne and the growth of Melbourne, maybe compared to some other cities, is the city, you know, you still kind of can get to farms within an hour outside of Melbourne. Mm. So there's a lot of awesome growers that kind of just basically border the inner suburbs of Melbourne. So we, you know, get Somerset Heritage produce, Romaro from, we get a lot of stuff from those guys weekly or bi-weekly, and we kind of really try and drive our menu and get the bulk of our menu from them. It's also a super busy restaurant, so we do use other suppliers as well. But we really try and sort of source most of the things, and most of the things that we try and highlight will come from those kind of guys. We have lobster on the menu. We get that delivered from some guys down in Port Campbell on the Great Ocean Road. So they literally come direct, straight out of the water. That's in the restaurant in like
that's
two
amazing.
Or 3 hours.
Yeah.
And it, on a Tuesday, and it's on lunch. So you're eating lobster that's like 3 hours out of the water still. Like it's so good. So,
yeah.
So that's sort of, I guess, what like raises the level of the food from just being sort of like a concept, a classic concept or something like that, to food that's really good right now is the produce for sure.
Yeah. Epic. All right. Well, so to finish off, like, I think that it's worth acknowledging, like, you've excelled, like, in the head chef role, like you've worked at the best places in Melbourne and, you know, have been doing it for years and super experienced. And like, do you often get the question, when are you going to open your own place? Is that something that people ask you? Because I think when you get to a certain level, there might be this expectation from the hospitality community, the people around you or whatever, that it's, you know, the next step is opening your own shop or even pursuing sort of more of that media attention and things like that, and being one of those chefs that everyone's that's always in the media and very well recognized, like, or but at the same time, I think there are a lot of chefs out there like you that are happy cooking and that sort of thing. Like, do you feel an expectation?
I guess I do. Well, in terms of the media thing, like, I've never, my wife used to work in the music industry, and she managed some sort of well-known like rock bands in Australia. And she, I remember having this conversation with her and talking about putting yourself in the media light or having a strong presence on social media and things like that. And she was like, none of the music artists like doing it. They like sitting in their dark rooms and playing music.
Yeah.
None of them like posting on Instagram, and it's really hard to do it. And she, you know, this conversation's come up a lot about sort of where I'm at and who I am and where I'm working and you know, my presence in terms of that sort of thing and putting myself out there on social media. And it sort of came down to just like, if it's not for you, like, you quickly know if being into social media and stuff like that is either for you or it's not. You either like doing it or you hate doing it.
Yeah.
And I've never like loved doing it. I've always sort of I've never really felt a massive urge to kind of put my life out there, my personal life out there onto social media pages. And I kind of I guess one of the really nice things about working in this restaurant group, and well, for a restaurant group, is we have people who do it. We have people who are employed to look after the social media presence of those restaurants, and they take photos. We have professional photographers. Andrew's wife, Jo, is, she's almost like our professional group photographer now. Mm. And we do photo shoots weekly with new dishes or new drinks or things that are aimed to promote or direct, what our media attention needs, where our media attention needs to go. So it's, we do it within the group at a really, really high level, like a professional level. And it's very considered, and it's very formulated and stuff like that. So it's something where I definitely don't feel the pressure to do it.
Yeah, that's where a lot of it comes down to. If you are the owner of the restaurant, you have to, like, you're doing everything to get yourself out there. And so you are just the proxy person to do it. And obviously some people like it, some people don't.
Yeah.
A lot of time it is just out of necessity.
Definitely.
As much as searching it out.
If I had my own small business, I would absolutely be, posting every day and trying to, because it is an awesome way to advertise yourself.
Of course.
And it is super effective. But it's actually really nice and luxury, especially in this day and age, to not have to do it. Spend time on my phone. I think that going back to the start of this podcast, we were talking about, cooking as a trade and getting into it as a trade. It is still a trade. It is still, it is just a job. It's not, it definitely is not, doesn't have to be something that you don't need to be a superstar celebrity chef. Mm. You can have it as just a job, and you can still be doing it at the high level and be doing amazing stuff. And if anything, I guess the less time you're spending on the phone, the more time you're sort of spending reading books or cooking new things or learning new things.
So would you look to open your own restaurant one day, or do you think you are more happy and comfortable working in a group and as part of a sort of larger team?
Definitely. Look, at the moment, I think after, all the lockdowns and COVID and those sort of things, it's pretty nice to be part of a big team where you're working with humongous amount of resources and a humongous amount of talent to create something super amazing that is doing well and is successful and people are celebrating. Doing it by yourself right now would be just super, super tough. Mm. And I think for quite a while, I'm definitely open to the idea of and can see myself doing something one day. And I've always had this idea that, again, sort of figuring out that I'm much more of a team player rather than an individual. I've always sort of had this idea where I'd like to, find a team of people to do it with and the right players of that team to put together something and put together a restaurant. Because I think that it's something that's not, doing it by myself isn't something I'm sort of super interested in doing it. I think it's always, I go in and out of feeling like I want to do it and then sort of just going, there's no way I'd do that. It's, you're mental to do that. It's sort of tough. And I think, I think it's one of those things. It's such a huge thing to take on for someone financially and for their lifestyle, and you really need to be able to feel like it's the right thing.
Well, that's the thing, and it's like on paper right now, it's like you're in a position where like you've got your sort of like creative fix. You've got a great job and a great team, and you're at an awesome new restaurant and everything. It's like, it's all working. There's just so many uncertainties of opening your own place, with all the competition and the challenges and COVID and all these sorts of things. It's like if you put it down on paper, it's like fucking, you've got to be crazy, you know what I mean? But there's just something about it for a lot of chefs
But I don't think that's ever changed. Like, I don't think, people say that, in this day and age, you've got to be crazy to open a restaurant, because on paper you're better off putting your money just in a high interest savings account.
Yeah.
which is actually completely crazy. So if you're going to do it, you've got to kind of really, you've really got to want it.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a part of me that wants that for sure. Yeah. But I think all the things have to add up for you to really commit to doing something like that. But at the same time, people have opened restaurants for years.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. And it's all part of people's life story.
It's a big step for a lot of people, but it's also, it's not that crazy.
Well, you've also got the privilege, the experience of opening numerous venues as well. So like, it's not like you've just been,
definitely sort
of working at the odd place here and then you're like, I want to open my own shop.
Well, I have thought that, you know, like, and definitely acknowledge that, you know, the experience that I've built, especially working with, you know, with Andrew McConnell, has definitely sort of given me the training ground and an education in how to open a restaurant and how to manage a restaurant with, you know, and it would be a shame to not, you know, have a crack at it one day, but we'll see
how we go. Touch base again.
Yeah.
All right, I think we should wrap it up. That's almost us. We're going to dinner at Embla tonight, very excited about that, and then back at Gimlet tomorrow night for dinner, which is going to be very exciting. And because I know he's going to be super excited about this, let's give a shout out to Simon and Louisa and their new baby Daisy at the end, who's a mutual friend of ours in Wollongong.
Congratulations.
Anything else from you, Alan, before we finish?
No, I think that's it.
That's it?
It's been great.
Cool. Awesome chatting. Thank you so much for joining us, mate.
Awesome.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's simon_evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.